I want to start with a number that honestly it scares me a little. 13.7.
13.7 years.
Years, yeah. Specifically, we're talking about the time between, say, late 2025 and early 2039. The Reed Multiplex source material that we're digging into today calls this the abundance interregnum.
Right.
But if you strip away all the fancy terminology, what we're really talking about is a countdown.
And it absolutely is a countdown. And it's not just some, arbitrary window or a prediction pulled out of thin air. This is the 5,000 days timeline. The whole premise here, the thing we've been tracking, is that we're living in this very specific, very strange liminal space.
A space where the rules are changing.
Completely. The fundamental link, the one that's defined human society for millennia, between working for a living and, well, surviving, that link is being severed by AI and robotics.
Which, on paper sounds amazing. It sounds like utopia from some old sci-fi novel, but living through it in the day-to-day, it feels a lot more like anxiety.
It does. Feels like the floor is disappearing.
Exactly. And we've been covering the series for a while now. This is the Reed Multiplex podcast, after all. But today we're looking at part 12. It's titled Resurrection in the Reversal. And I have to say, the source material here takes a pretty hard left turn from the usual tech optimism you see everywhere
It
else.
really does. It stops focusing on the gigahertz and the parameter counts, and it starts looking at the psychology of it all, at us. The core argument here is about this one word, obsolescence.
A word nobody wants to hear.
Right. Usually when we hear that word, we think of, I don't know, an old flip phone in a junk drawer. We think useless. We think it's over.
You think of being discarded, being left behind.
But the sources we're looking at, and they're drawing heavily on the prophetic work of Norbert Wiener and J.C.R. Licklider, they argue that obsolescence is actually a crucible.
A crucible, so a trial by fire.
Exactly. It's an initiation ritual. The source says when the machine takes the drudgery of your job, the repetitive tasks, it doesn't just leave a hole. It creates a vacuum that sort of forces you to become something else.
Something else. Okay, that's the mystery, isn't it? That's what we're trying to solve in this deep dive. Because if I'm not my job title, and if a machine can do the tasks of my job better, faster, and cheaper than me, then what am I?
That is the question, the central question of the 5,000 days. And to even begin to answer it, we have to go back in time. We have to go back to the 1940s to a mathematician who realized that the way we think about machines and the way we think about ourselves were about to collide in a very big way.
Before we jump into the history, though, let's just frame where we are in this 5,000 Days series, because this isn't just a collection of articles. It's built on a very specific narrative structure, which I think is key to understanding it.
It is. It's absolutely fundamental. The series uses Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, the monomyth, to map the psychological evolution of the entire human race during this transition.
So it's not just about economics.
No, it reframes this economic crisis we're seeing, with all the headlines about layoffs and automation, not as some random disaster, but as an initiation, a collective one.
Which is a really helpful framework, I think, because without it, the news just looks like pure chaos. It's terrifying. But if you can view it as a story, as a journey, you can at least try to find where you are on the map.
Exactly. And if you look at the journey so far, we're talking parts 1 through 11, it tracks almost perfectly with the Kubler-Ross model of grief. It's fascinating.
So we started with the grief cycle.
We did. We started with the call and the threshold in parts 1 and 2. That was the initial wake-up call, the moment you realize this is real. And it was about dealing with the grief of leaving the old world, the predictable world, behind.
That was the denial phase. AI is just a fad, or I can't write poetry, or it'll never replace a real artist, all that stuff.
Precisely, the bargaining. Then we moved into the danger in parts 3 and 4. This is where the source material talked about the player piano risk.
The player piano, automation that feels empty.
Yes, automation causing this deep alienation. If the machines do everything, do we matter?
Right.
Do we have a purpose? The challenge there was to reframe this coming abundance as liberation, not just, cosmic boredom.
Which led us, and I think a lot of people are here right now, to the ordeal, parts 5 and 6, you're de-skilling.
This is the hard part. This is the dark forest of the journey. It's the pain of losing your old identities. If you spend 20 years of your life being a graphic designer or a coder or a copywriter, and a machine can now do it almost instantly, you feel that de-skilling in your bones. It's a profound identity crisis.
I feel like a lot of our listeners are probably nodding along right now, stuck right there in the ordeal.
I think most of us are. It's a painful place to be. But the series argues that it's not the end, it moves forward. Parts 7 through 9 were about the shift. Finding meaning beyond pure utility. The source even references I&M Banks' Culture series there. It was about saving human wisdom and the artisan's awakening.
The resurgence of craft, of things made by hand.
Yes, the return to the tactile. And now we're at the tipping point, the reversal of obsolescence, based on Marshall McLuhan's Tetrad. We're at part 12. This is the moment where defeat is supposed to flip to victory.
So the mission of this specific deep dive, then, is to figure out how we stick that landing. How do we actually move from the ordeal to the resurrection? And the source material points us to two very specific guides for this part of the journey, Norbert Wiener and J.C.R. Licklider.
The prophet and the architect. That's what the source calls them.
Let's start with the prophet, then. Let's start with Wiener. I knew the name, obviously cybernetics, but I have to admit, I didn't realize how deeply integral he is to understanding this specific moment we're in right now.
He's everything. To understand Wiener, you have to understand the problem he was trying to solve during World War II. It wasn't code breaking like Turing, it was something more dynamic, it was ballistics.
You mean like shooting down planes?
Exactly. The German bombers were flying fast. Too fast.
Too fast for a human gunner to track and lead the target.
Way too fast for the human reaction time. Think about it. By the time the gunner's eye saw the plane, and his brain calculated the trajectory, and his nervous system told his hand to crank the gun, and the shell actually flew through the air, the plane was miles away. You're always, always shooting at a ghost.
So you have to predict the future. You have to shoot where the plane is going to be. But the pilot is actively trying to evade you. It's random.
See, that's the thing. It looks random. But Wiener, as this incredible prodigy, realized it wasn't truly random.
How so?
Even a pilot trying to dodge is still a human being in a machine. They're under physical constraints. Oh. Gravity, momentum, the turning radius of the plane, and maybe most importantly, fear. Human psychology. Wiener realized that if you treat the pilot's behavior not as random noise, but as a pattern of information, a stream of inputs and outputs, you could start to predict the future statistically.
Okay, hold on. This is the famous anti-aircraft predictor. He's literally building a machine that predicts the future.
In a very specific way. He's building it around a feedback loop. This is the birth of cybernetics. It's so elegant. The gun fires. It misses. The system sees the error, the distance between the shell's explosion and the plane, and it feeds that error, that new piece of information, back into the equation to correct the very next shot.
So it learns from its own mistake.
Instantly.
Yeah.
And this is the critical takeaway, the thing that changes everything. Wiener proved that purposeful behavior, like trying to hit a moving target, is just a negative feedback loop. It's a system trying to reduce the error between its goal and its current state.
And it doesn't matter if that system is a human brain or a circuit board with vacuum tubes.
It doesn't matter. If it corrects its error based on feedback from the environment, it is thinking. In a cybernetic sense, it is behaving purposefully.
That's deeply unsettling because it implies that intelligence, this thing we hold so sacred, isn't some magical soul stuff. It's just error correction.
Which is precisely why Norbert Wiener got scared. Really scared. He looked at this anti-aircraft gun, this machine he'd helped create, and he had this terrifying realization. We just built a machine that acts like a biological organism. And if we can scale this up, we aren't just building better tools anymore. We are building a new species of labor.
And this is where the prophet title really comes into play. He saw this 5,000 days crisis coming 80 years ago.
He absolutely did. In 1947, he published an article in The Atlantic called A Scientist Rebels. He publicly refused to share his work with military contractors ever again because he'd seen the destruction of the war and he saw where this was headed. He later wrote a book called The Human Use of Human Beings.
The title alone tells you everything you need to know about his perspective.
It does. His warning was so stark, so clear. He said, if we use these new automatic machines to simply replace humans, to treat human beings as inefficient slave labor that we can just discard, we degrade humanity itself. He had this quote, and it's central to the whole deep dive. The automatic machine is the precise economic equivalent of slave labor.
Wow. So if you try to compete with the machine on its own terms, pure efficiency, raw speed, calculation, you will always lose. You effectively become the slave in that relationship.
You lose your humanity by trying to be a bad machine.
Exactly.
But, and this is the hopeful part, if we use them properly as partners, we can liberate ourselves. And that brings us to the man who took Wiener's profound warning and turned it into an actual blueprint for the future. J.C.R. Licklider.
Licklider. Okay, so he's the essential link here. Because Wiener gave us the fundamental mechanism, the feedback loop, and the warning. But Licklider gave us the strategy.
He did. Licklider was a psychologist by training, which is really important. He was interested in the human mind. But he was at MIT, and he sat at Wiener's table. He went to the Macy conferences. He absorbed all these ideas about cybernetics and feedback loops. But he added the crucial next step. In 1960, he published this seminal paper, Man-Computer Symbiosis.
Symbiosis. Not domination, not replacement. Partnership.
Partnership. That's the word. The core concept was that humans and computers could be coupled so tightly together that they would effectively think thoughts that no single mind, whether human or machine, could ever reach on its own.
It's like a turbo boost for the brain. But how does that actually work in practice? Because right now, for a lot of people, it feels like the computer is doing the thinking for me, not with me.
And that's the danger Wiener saw. Licklider's vision was different. He broke it down by a clear division of labor. The computers, he said, are brilliant at the routine, the rote tasks, data retrieval, real-time simulation. The desk, as he called it, becomes this sacred station of computational power.
Okay, so the machine handles the what?
It handles the what and the how, but the humans, we handle the why. We set the goals. We frame the questions. We formulate the hypotheses. And most importantly, we judge the values.
It's the difference between the engine and the steering wheel. The engine provides the power, but the human decides the destination.
That's a perfect analogy. And Licklider was the one who literally steered us toward what we now call the internet. When he was at ARPA in the early 60s, he sketched out his vision for an intergalactic computer network.
The intergalactic computer network? I love that.
It's fantastic, right? But his vision wasn't just about connecting machines. It was about linking machines globally so that humans could share knowledge and collaborate. He saw the fork in the road so clearly, even back then. He knew we could build a future of domination, the AI overlord. Or we could build a future of symbiosis, the AI partner. He chose partner. He bet on us.
So we have Wiener giving us the mechanism of the feedback loop and Licklider giving us the partnership model. This brings us to the core thesis of this deep dive. The source material outlines what it calls three lanterns to light the path ahead.
These are the guiding principles, the things you need to hold on to get through the reversal without losing your way.
Let's hit the first one. It's a big one. Society is a system of messages.
This is pure Wiener. He said, society can only be understood through a study of the messages and the communication facilities which belong to it. So in the age of AI, the algorithms that curate our feeds, that write our emails, that suggest our next purchase, they are the message stream.
So we have to look at the purpose behind those messages.
We have to. Are they serving manipulation for profit, or are they serving truth, connection, and human flourishing? It forces you to be critical of the information ecosystem you live in.
Okay, but this feels a little abstract. Society is messages. What does that mean for, say, the person who just got laid off because an AI took their job?
It means their job wasn't just labor, it was a message. It was a message they were sending to society about their value, their competence, their contribution, and the paycheck they got back. That was a message society sent back saying, yes, you were valued. When that feedback loop breaks, the silence is deafening. It's an existential crisis.
Which leads right into the second lantern, combating entropy. Now, this is a physics term, but the source uses it psychologically, which I found really interesting.
It's the second law of thermodynamics. At its core, it just means that in a closed system, disorder always increases. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. That's entropy.
The natural tendency toward chaos.
Precisely. And life, consciousness, intelligence, these are the only things in the known universe that seem to push back against it. We use information and feedback to create these tiny, temporary pockets of order. A garden, a family, a symphony.
Okay, so connect this to the psychological obsolescence we're talking about, the feeling of being useless.
Think about it. When a machine takes your job, all those rote tasks you did every day, the structure of your week, you feel a void. That void, that sense of aimlessness and chaos, is entropy flooding into your life. The old order is gone.
And the resurrection is about building a new order.
It's about filling that void with higher order creation, with things only a human can do. Art, science, philosophy, community, soul work. You're pushing back against the encroaching chaos by creating something new and meaningful.
That makes so much sense. We feel the chaos because the external structure of the job has been removed. So we have to build a new internal structure.
A structure based on purpose, not just utility. And that requires the third lantern, which is maybe the most important, technology and human service. This is the synthesis of Wiener and Licklider. The human must hold the reins. The machine proposes.
Hey, this is Bayard Winthrop, founder of American Giant. I started this company because I was fed up with cheap clothes that didn't last and a system that shipped manufacturing overseas. We believed we could still make incredible hoodies, t-shirts, and pants right here in the U.S. with American cotton, American factories, and people earning real wages. That's what American Giant stands for, building clothes that actually last. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com.
The human disposes.
The machine proposes, the human disposes. That is the absolute definition of the solution. Okay, let's get out of the clouds now. The whole promise of these Reed Multiplex deep dives is that we land the plane on practical ground. How do we do this?
We have to live this. It can't just be theory.
And the source material, drawing really heavily on Brian Rommel's work, provides 5 specific, actionable solutions on how to live this resurrection today, not in 2039. Today. And I really want to spend the bulk of our time here because this is where the rubber meets the road.
This is the toolkit. This is how you move from that scarcity mindset where your self-worth is tied to your toil to what the source calls sovereign mastery, where your worth is tied to your purpose.
Okay. Solution number 1, engineering personal feedback loops. Now, I'll be totally honest. When I first read this, it sounded a bit like a self-help diary. You know, write down your day.
It does sound like Dear Diary, right?
Yeah.
I had the same reaction at first.
Yeah.
But you have to look at it through the lens of what we just discussed about Wiener and that anti-aircraft gun.
Okay, walk me through it. Remind me.
In this scenario, you are both the pilot and the gunner. The problem with so much of modern life and why we feel this creeping entropy, this chaos, is that we have broken our own feedback loops. We doom scroll on social media. We work on autopilot. We binge watch. We sleep. There's no reflection. We don't measure the error.
We don't stop to see where we miss the target of the person we want to be.
Exactly. So Rommel's suggestion isn't just journaling. It's about consciously closing the circuit. The practice is this. Each evening, you feed a distilled summary of your day, your actions, your feelings, your key interactions, into a large language model.
Yeah.
A private, secure one, obviously.
Okay, so you give it the raw data.
You give it the data. And then, and this is the critical part of the prompt, you don't just ask, how was my day? You ask it something specific like, based on my stated values of patience, creativity, connection, identify patterns in my behavior today where I drifted from those values, surface one small actionable adjustment I could make tomorrow.
Ah, you're using the AI as the error detector. You're asking it to be the cybernetic system that spots the gap between the goal and the reality.
You're using the AI to literally combat entropy in your own life. The second law of thermodynamics says everything drifts towards disorder. The only thing that fights that drift is information. By forcing the AI to extract a meaningful pattern from the chaotic data of your day, you are creating order. You are extracting signal from noise.
So when the AI comes back and says, hey, you got angry with your kids at 2 p.m. and it seems to happen every time you skip lunch, that's not just diet advice. That's signal extraction from the noise of your life.
That's cybernetics applied to the soul. You are becoming the steersman of your own life, which, by the way, is the direct Greek root of the word cybernetics. Kybernetes, the pilot, the one who steers the ship.
That reframing actually makes me want to try it. It's less Dear Diary and more.
Yeah.
I don't know. Captain's log.
It's taking the wheel back. And the second part of the solution is the action. This is the Licklider part. The machine proposes the adjustment, eat lunch at 1 p.m. The human disposes. You make the choice to actually do it. And then you log the result the next day. Did it work? Was the outcome better? If yes, the loop is closed. If no, you adjust the strategy and try again.
That is incredibly powerful. It really does turn the AI into a mirror, a tool for self-reflection rather than a master or an oracle.
It creates a personal self-correcting circuit for growth.
Okay, let's move on to solution number 2, embedding humane purpose in prompting. This feels like it touches directly on Licklider's idea of symbiosis. But again, let's make it practical. How does this change how I type into a chat box?
I think we need to stop settling for raw efficiency. Right now, most people use AI to just get it done. Write this email, summarize this report, plan this trip.
Make it sound professional. That's the one I see all the time.
Right. What does the AI do? It gives you the statistical average of every professional email it's ever been trained on, which is usually bland, generic, and slightly soulless. Rommel's argument is that we need to stop prompting for tasks and start prompting for values. We have to inject our purpose into the command.
Can you give me a concrete example?
Okay, let's say you're a writer. You could just ask an AI, write an intro for a blog post about coffee, and it'll give you something utterly generic. You know, coffee is one of the world's most popular beverages.
Which is technically true, but emotionally dead. It has no flavor.
Exactly. It's entropic communication. Instead, you shift the goal. You change the prompt. You ask the model to generate three opening paragraphs for an article about coffee that honor the dignity of the reader's time and the simple beauty of a morning ritual.
Wow. Okay. Honor the dignity of the reader. That's a completely different instruction.
It's a values-based instruction. You explicitly command it to care about beauty and respect. Now, the machine doesn't feel dignity, of course, but it has processed millions of texts, from philosophy to poetry to great novels, that discuss dignity. It knows the pattern of dignity. By invoking that pattern, you force the machine to aim for a higher quality of output.
And then this is the crucial human disposes part. You don't just copy and paste the result. You use it as a starting point.
You use it as your creative partner. You take its best attempt, and then you refine it. You polish it. You add the soul, the specific memory, the neurons that only a biological being with lived experience can provide.
The source gives another great example with parenting.
Yes, the scheduling assistant. If you're using an AI to schedule your family's week, don't just ask it to fit everything in or optimize for time management. Ask it to optimize for emotional connection.
That is such a profound shift. Optimize for emotional connection. I can't imagine what it would even suggest.
Well, it might look at the schedule and say, hey, you have a 20-minute gap between your work call and your son's soccer practice. That's enough time for a short walk together where you can connect. The machine implies the logistics. The human supplies the love. That, right there, is the difference between subservience and Licklider symbiosis.
You're using the machine to remind you to be more human.
Precisely. You're using its computational power to serve your highest values.
Solution number three. This one is my personal favorite, I think, because I'm a sucker for analog things, reclaiming the tactile analog. But my first question is, why is this a solution to the AI problem? Kind of feels like running away from it.
It's not running away. It's balancing the equation. It's about grounding.
Yeah.
The source has this amazing line. In an age of digital abundance, friction is the ultimate luxury.
Friction is the ultimate luxury. Okay, unpack that for me.
Think about the digital world. Everything is smooth, glass screens, instant answers, zero resistance. If you want an image of a medieval castle, you type some words and poof, there it is. You don't have to quarry the stone, mix the mortar, or hoist the blocks. But we, as human beings, evolved over millions of years in a world of physical resistance, of gravity, of the grain of wood, of the heft of a stone. When we lose that constant feedback, we lose our anchor to reality. We can start to feel like we're just floating away in this entropic digital fog.
So the solution is to deliberately, consciously build friction back into our lives.
Yes. And the source suggests very specific, tangible activities. Build a small wooden box with hand tools.
Not with a 3D printer, with a saw and a chisel.
With a saw and a chisel. Feel the resistance of the wood grain as the saw bites into it. The wood fights back. The screen never fights back. It just yields instantly. Or another example, write a letter on good paper with the fountain pen.
Oh, the fountain pen. I love that. You have to be careful with those. You can't just mash it down like a cheap ballpoint. You have to find the right angle, the right pressure.
Exactly. The ink has weight. The paper has texture. If you pause your thought for too long in one spot, the ink bleeds. That is feedback. It's real-world physics talking back to you. An AI can simulate the sound of a violin perfectly, but it cannot simulate the feeling of the string vibrating through the wood and into your fingertip and jawbone.
And that physical feedback loops back into your psyche. It reminds you that you exist in a physical body, in the real world. It's grounding.
It anchors you. Wiener and Licklider both knew this. We are biological beings. We cannot just upload our consciousness into the cloud and expect to remain fully human. We need the tactile to balance the digital.
It's a fascinating paradox. The more advanced and frictionless the AI gets, the more valuable a smudged, handwritten note becomes. Because it proves a human was there.
It proves time and effort and care were spent. And in an emerging economy of instant, effortless abundance, effort becomes the new currency of love and meaning.
Let's talk about solution number four. Curating message ecosystems. This sounds a bit more social, more about community.
This is about how we talk to each other. It goes back to that first lantern. Wiener's saying society is a system of messages. If all our messages become texts and tweets and algorithmically generated feeds, society itself starts to degrade. It loses coherence.
So what's the practical ritual here? What's the solution?
It's simple and radical at the same time. Gather friends, for a physical dinner, unplugged. A strict no phones on the table rule.
Okay, that's old school, but we've heard put down the phone a million times. What's the new twist here?
The twist is in how you leverage AI before and after the human event. You use the AI as a research assistant to prep provocative, deep questions. You don't just show up and ask, how is work? You prime the pump. You go to your AI and say, give me 5 powerful conversation starters for a dinner party based on the philosophy of Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey and Eric Fromm's The Art of Loving.
Oh, that is cool. So you're using the AI to deliberately upgrade the depth and quality of the human conversation?
Right. You aren't just gossiping or talking about the weather. You're using the time to discuss the nature of love or the structure of a meaningful life. You're using the machine to provide high-quality intellectual fuel for the human fire. And then, and this is the really interesting part, you record the dialogue, with everyone's permission, of course.
Okay.
And afterward, you feed the transcript to a model and ask it to synthesize the key themes, insights, and unresolved questions from your group's conversation into a shared document.
So you're creating a living archive, a record of your friend group's collective wisdom over time.
Exactly. You are using the technology to capture, clarify, and preserve human connection, not to replace it. It steers your little corner of civilization away from alienation and toward meaning. It transforms a simple dinner party into a modern-day salon.
It makes the conversation feel like it mattered, like it wasn't just noise that dissipated into the air.
It combats the entropy of forgetting. It creates a pocket of shared order.
And that brings us to the final one, solution number 5, stepping into vocation.
This is the big one. This is the end game of the 5,000 days. This is the gift you bring back from the underworld.
And we really need to distinguish between work or a job and a vocation.
We do. Work, in the industrial sense that we're leaving behind, was often about survival, about utility, about doing what the machine now does better. Move this box from A to B. Calculate this column of numbers. A vocation is different. It's a calling. The source defines it as choosing pursuits that machines can enhance, but never, ever truly own.
Okay, give us some concrete examples from the source, because people are panicked about their jobs. They need to see what this looks like.
Mentoring. A great example. Mentoring young people in deep reading, critical thinking, or ethics. An AI can teach you facts. It can explain the quadratic formula, but it cannot model what it means to be a wise, compassionate, resilient adult. That is a fundamentally human vocation.
Another one mentioned was the Neighborhood Repair Cafe. I love that idea.
It's brilliant. You're fixing objects, yes, but you're also fixing stories. You aren't just fixing a broken toaster. You're gathering your community. You're teaching skills. You're showing that things and people have value and are worth repairing, not just discarding. Or something like philosophical inquiry, writing essays that explore the meaning of life in this new era.
These are all the things we told ourselves we didn't have time for when we were grinding 60 hours a week just to pay the rent.
And this is the elixir in the language of the hero's journey. These vocations are the gifts the hero brings back from the ordeal. You went through the de-skilling, you faced the dark night of obsolescence, and you came back with the most valuable skills of all. The ability to mentor, to repair, to think deeply, to connect.
It's powerful stuff. It really does reframe the whole fear narrative around AI. It suggests that maybe the job as we knew it was actually holding us back from our true vocation.
It does. It tells us that this interregnum, this messy, chaotic 13-year period, isn't a waiting room where we hope for the old world to come back. It's a construction site, and we are the architects of what comes next.
So as we start to wrap up this deep dive into part 12, Resurrection and the Reversal, let's just try to bring it all together. We've gone from a World War II anti-aircraft gun all the way to a neighborhood dinner party.
The hero rises. That's the stage of the journey we are entering now. Obsolescence has dismantled the old identity, the old ego. It hurt. It was terrifying. But the resurrection isn't something that happens to you. It's something you build.
And the interregnum, the 5,000 days, is the resurrection chamber.
It's the workshop. Exactly. And the call to action for you, for everyone listening, is to use Wiener and Licklider as your guides. Use these 5 solutions as your tools. Do not just try to survive the reversal. Don't just cling to your old job description and hope for the best. The goal is to emerge sovereign.
The 5,000 days continue. The journey deepens. That's how the source ends this section.
And I want to leave our listeners with one final provocative thought. It comes straight from Norbert Wiener himself.
Let's hear it.
In his work, Wiener wrote, "We are not stuff that abides, but patterns that perpetuate ourselves."
Patterns that perpetuate ourselves. Say a bit more about that.
We aren't our atoms. They're replaced every few years. We aren't our job titles. They can be taken away in an instant. We are the patterns of our thoughts, our behaviors, our relationships, our values, our love. That is the us that continues. So the question for you, listening right now, is this. In this new era where the machines can replicate almost any pattern of labor or skill, what patterns are you choosing to weave?
That is the question.
That is the only question that matters now.
Thank you for listening to the Read Multiplex podcast. This has been our deep dive into the 5,000 Days series. Go build your feedback loops, reclaim the tactile, and we will see you on the other side of the reversal.
See you there.
Hey, this is Bayard Winthrop, founder of American Giant. I started this company because I was fed up with cheap clothes that didn't last and a system that shipped manufacturing overseas. We believed we could still make incredible hoodies, t-shirts, and pants right here in the U.S. with American cotton, American factories, and people earning real wages. That's what American Giant stands for, building clothes that actually last. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com.